And welcome to another Hope Rehab Mindfulness Compassion Show. My name is Paul Garrigan and I look after the mindfulness program here at Hope.
I'm Simon. I'm the treatment director and founder of Hope.
And I believe today you're going to interview me about mindfulness, is that right?
Yes, I thought we'll reverse roles here and I'll ask you a few questions about mindfulness.
Far away.
Okay, yes. What occurs to me is that mindfulness and meditation is age old as the hills, yet seemingly quite new in addiction treatment. In fact, of course, it's being used in mental health treatment and many other areas, stress management, all over the place. So how is it that we've only just cottoned on to this wonderful resource?
A lot of it has to be credited to sort of people who came to places like here in Thailand during the 70s and 80s, people like Joseph Goldstein, and these are sort of the early sort of founders of, you know, mindfulness in the West. And the thing that really sort of helped it take off, see, for a lot of people, they would have tied mindfulness in very strictly with, as a religious thing in Buddhism, you know. But what they were very careful to do with people, especially people like Jon Kabat-Zinn, was to, like, you know, take the very useful stuff out and not only present it in a more secular way, but also to begin encouraging studies into it and the relevance of it. So people have known for thousands of years that this sort of approach can help, but sort of bring it to a wider audience.
Right. Do you think there was any resistance in the Western world, should we say, in the sort of medical fraternity, should we say, in therapeutic world, let's say that sort of hardcore of psychology, you know, any resistance in accepting?
I think there always will be some type of resistance, but I think a lot of the stuff, it fits in nicely with some of the way people were leaning anyway. And you can sort of see an influence. So you even have like people with CBT who were sort of talking about, they're obviously influenced by some of the stuff coming from mindfulness, especially this idea of having a more objective relationship with thinking.
Right. So, yeah. So it's not in parallel, really, to other developments. Okay.
So, yeah, you can sort of say this is the right time for mindfulness in the West. And it's sort of filling holes that are much needed.
Right, because, and I suppose if I draw on my own experience 20 years ago going to treatment, you know, we might have done a bit of relaxation, but it wasn't treated seriously,
yeah,
mindfulness.
You're right. So, I mean, when I first came in contact with the idea of mindfulness, the Eastern idea, through martial arts, and in those days, this is during the 80s, if you'd have said to people about mindfulness, that would have meant, be careful, you need to be careful.
Oh, yes.
It sort of had a different meaning.
Yes.
And sorry, you're right, it's only recently in the last couple of decades or so that we start to see this as this Eastern approach. That's, you know, it's an Eastern approach that's increasingly supported by sort of Western evidence.
Mm.
And it's particularly, you know, from this sort of, one of the great sort of central, the core ideas of this, of the mindfulness approach, is that most of our suffering, or indeed all of our suffering, comes from a relationship we have with thoughts and feelings, in particular craving. And the core idea is that using these techniques, it's possible to develop a mind that's sort of free from craving, and that's why it's so important for, or why it can be so useful for people struggling with addiction problems.
Okay. All right. Well, then bringing it more into today and what we do here at Hope. So how do you sort of, how do you find introducing mindfulness to the 20 odd clients that we have at one time? You know, how is it? How receptive are they?
So one of the first things I say to clients when they come here is that their brain has been tricking them. And this is why, you know, they can get up in the morning, and just like I did, and sort of say, you know, no matter what happens today, I'm not going to drink. And yet 2 hours later, I will be drinking. So the only way that can happen is if somehow my brain has been tricking me, because I was never like insincere when I made that promise to myself or to other people. I actually really meant it. but somehow within 2 hours my brain would change and it would sort of do something that I didn't want it to do.
Mm. Mm.
So the thing about a trick, your brain tricking you, I mean, some people will believe that right off the bat. They're quite happily to believe that their brain is tricking them. But even if they can do that, it's not really enough. It's like in the same way that we know someone like Darren Brown, you know, the illusionist, that he's not really like Harry Potter. But knowing that he's sort of tricking us doesn't stop him from tricking us. We have to be able to see the trick. And the whole process that we do here is to sort of lead people to being able to see the trick. So I say there's basically three parts to this. And it's all tied into our well-being. Because I honestly believe for most people who turn to alcohol or drugs generally, their main aim is well-being. They want well-being. And you can sort of say happiness is a subjective experience of well-being. And if I can, you know, if I can sort of show them, if I can let people sort of taste what real well-being is like, that would be a great step forward. And then the thing is to show them, just like, you know, you talk about the step one here, we really focus on this powerlessness thing. If people can then clearly see why their well-being can never, ever be satisfied, not only through alcohol or drugs, but through all types of those behaviors, why it can never, ever be possible. Because what we start to find with the well-being is actually the absence of seeking. That's what well-being is. So, and the problem with drugs is it actually increases seeking, so it can never, ever be a solution. And any relief we get from alcohol or drugs is only temporary. This is why I've never met anyone who sort of says, I really wish I got drunk yesterday. Because whatever we did in the past is of no value to us now. And it's, we have to keep on repeating these behaviors, which only give us a temporary relief and ultimately, you know, make us less likely to enjoy well-being.
Mm.
Now, when people really get this, it can change everything.
Mm.
And they start to see that all suffering is due to a similar type of seeking. It's like we're constantly trying to get something inside to fix ourselves. And it just can't work because it's all sort of the same limitation as alcohol or drugs, because any relief we get is temporary.
Mm.
But then we actually start to find out, is this well-being inside of us?
Right, okay, yeah, so that makes a lot of sense to me, and it ties in with, of course, the 12-step approach, which we also use some of it here. And, of course, when you mentioned, you know, I'm not going to drink today, 2 hours, and every addict and alcoholic knows that, you know, has made all those promises to oneself and other people, and then 2 hours later. And of course, that's what we call, like you said, powerlessness or that compulsive nature. So how are they going to use mindfulness to break that?
So it's basically the mind, the mind or the brain isn't deliberately trying to deceive us. It's a misunderstanding.
Mm-hmm.
So what we start to find is that when we don't give in to these cravings, there's a peace there by not giving in to them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, so the way I explain this to clients, like imagine that you had this dream of coming to Thailand. And that was your big thing, was to come to Thailand and you're going to lie in a hammock and it's going to be fantastic. And you save up all year. And you eventually get here and you're lying in your hammock. And for 5 minutes, it's absolutely wonderful.
Mm.
But then something happens. A thought appears in your brain saying, you know what, an ice cream, I'd like an ice cream now. Now, before that thought, you are already at the maximum well-being. You are at a 10.
Mm.
And by going for that ice cream, it's not going to add anything to your well-being.
Mm.
In fact, it's going to generate more discontent, because when you get to the ice cream, you're going, oh, I wish I was back in the hammock. I wish I was doing this and I wish I was doing that. Now, there is a time to get up from the hammock, but that was not a good one. If we can simply let go of that thought, just let that thought go by, we can extend our time just relaxing in the hammock.
Mm.
And we get to really see this for ourselves. When we see it, when we see what's happening, it gets very easy. And it's like the brain just gets it. And we become, when we sort of see that our well-being is already here and it's already at maximum, we're less tempted to leave that.
Mm. Right.
We can more easily just let the thoughts go by. And the more you do it, the better you get at it. And this exact same thing applies to cravings. You start to say, my well-being is higher when I don't give in to the craving, not when I do. Because that craving, I can clearly see now, beyond any doubt, that giving into that craving only leads to my suffering.
So ideally, our clients will take this on board, and then what, they use a practice that you teach them?
Yeah, so once we get through those first, the first two steps are like the sort of providing the evidence, and once someone very clearly sees that, this is what, my well-being is just when I'm not seeking, and I can sort of see how the drugs, can possibly help with this. This then gives them the motivation. Well, how do I make this more a part of my life?
Yeah.
And so we have this process. We have these four steps. The first step is the most basic. We learn to start resting in our body. We learn to start putting our attention on physical sensation. And this is the exact same thing that people do naturally. It's a meditation that people naturally do. Mm-hmm. I got very mentally stressed, during my 20s, I ended up on the streets. And one of the things I did was pace around all day. When I trained as a nurse, I did part of my training on a psychiatric ward. And one of the things I noticed there was people pacing all the time.
Mm.
We're intuitively trying to practice this mindfulness because our attention can only be on one thing at a time.
Mm.
And when our attention is on physical sensation, we start to rest in the body. And we start to notice that when we're not lost in the thinking, we like it. We actually start to be drawn to that.
Mm.
And then the question is, how do I get more of it?
Right.
And so I'm going to the second level I call opening up. And it's about reconnecting with our feelings. We start to understand that quite early on, there's certain thoughts we can easily not get attached to. We can easily not give in to that first thought of the ice cream. But there are other thoughts that are much, much harder not to get sucked into.
Mm.
And these tend to be around feelings like, why did he just say that? What did she mean when she just ignored me?
Mm.
They're become very, very sticky.
Mm.
So we have these practices that make us not be so pulled by those sort of thinking. And it involves getting much more in touch with our emotions. And most importantly, developing compassion around our emotions, where we start to be able to lean into them. Because a lot of our problems come from trying to escape our emotions. And that's like, people like Carl Jung taught about neuroses. And this neurosis is like the pain we experience when we try to avoid legitimate pain. It's like, so the emotions is the legitimate pain. But when we actually start to lean into them, we find that they're not really that big a deal, really at all. So the third step then, once we can sort of start to not be so respondent to emotional disturbance in the body, we start to find it much easier to get deeper and deeper into concentration. And this is very important because now we can start to examine the brain. Now we can start to see the trick. This goes to the core. So also, the way we present mindfulness isn't Buddhist, but it's very much influenced by Buddhism.
Mm.
And the Buddha made one key claim, that it's possible to train your mind to become, no longer at the mercy of craving. And this is where we do it, through insight. We start to see, once the brain sees exactly what's going on, once the brain very, very clearly sees that getting up from that hammock at that moment to get an ice cream is not going to improve its well-being, it stops doing it. And that's what the insight is. It's not knowing, it's not believing a new thing, it's a complete shift in how we react to the world, and it's very, very natural.
Mm. Right, and the fourth?
The fourth is the insight.
That's the insight.
So you have the deeply concentration and it leads to this insight.
Okay, yeah, I see. And so, in practical terms, what do they do? Wake up every morning? I mean, you.
So the first thing we do when clients come here is I hand them a pair of beads.
Right.
And basically that's a lazy man's pacing. So rather than having the pace up and down everywhere, they can just put their attention on feeling the beads.
Right.
So that's the very first thing they do. And the fact that they're doing that, this will serve a number of functions. It will get them to sort of focus more on their body, but also it's building up their concentration for meditation. It's a very simple meditation.
Oh, right.
And they'll get better at it.
Yes.
So it's a nice gentle, because even if you're in really bad withdrawal symptoms, you can still hold on to some beers and just get that relief, because it's something we do anyway.
It's a good distraction and a focus.
Yes. It's a good way to focus.
Yeah. Oh, I see. Okay. And then, well, basically the mindfulness program here, apart from the teachings, what is it, daily practice?
So we have daily meditation here. We've got one-to-ones where we just, you know, we very personalize the mindfulness programs, because some people are going to, you know, have difficulty with different aspects of it probably, or misunderstandings. I mean, and it can sound very, very counterintuitive, you know, because one of the, some people are very kind of shocked with the idea that we can have an objective relationship with our thinking, because for most of us, we think we are the thinking.
Mm.
And so this idea of saying, oh, you can actually sort of look at your thoughts in a different way, can be quite shocking. We have sort of, and that can be only sometimes explained in a kind of one-to-one situation.
Mm. Yes, yeah. And that sort of ties in with the CBT, what we try to teach people, and then not necessarily their thoughts, but they also can change their thinking behavior.
But I think the clients here, I mean, we definitely give them you definitely get a good introduction to them. I mean, you can't cover it all, obviously, but I think there's a lot of errors we put into it, which is great, I think.
And then what the intention is that they will then continue this when they
this needs to be continued. You know, it needs to be as a meditation, a daily meditation practice. I mean, eventually people can start to gain insights, and these insights do lead to changes. But to sort of to maintain mental clarity, we need mental clarity to be in a much better. With mental clarity, our minds won't trick us so easily.
Right. Okay. Well, that's given a nice overview of what we do here at Hope and your meditation teachings and practice. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Simon.
I'll send Samina down.